You're listening to the Physio Matters podcast, this month in association with Health and Work Matters, and this is session 15. Welcome back to the Physio Matters podcast with me, Jack Chu. And firstly, a huge thank you to those of you sharing and promoting our previous episodes over the last month. It's really appreciated. We had just under 4,500 downloads within the first hour post-release of session 14 with Ben Smith. And we were getting tweets and Facebook comments as feedback before I'd even checked. It was out across all platforms. Unbelievable response again. So many thanks for your feedback, reviews, and of course, hate mail. So keep them coming. Much like Ben from our last episode, today's podcast guest is a physio from the coalface. Heather Watson, known as @HWMatters on Twitter, is an MSK physio with a wealth of experience and expertise working with patients who have work-related issues. As she explains in the interview, this includes frontline acute at-work services, but also consultancy services for problem cases where she gets impressive results despite being often a 10th opinion in complex and chronic problems. We're incredibly privileged to have Heather on the show as she agrees with the Choose Health way of disseminating good practice in order to best help patient care across the world. So let's get to it. Now, listeners may be tuning in for session 15 expecting an interview with British number one tennis player Heather Watson. So please, could you clear up the confusion, introduce yourself and your current role for us all?
Yeah, hi there. Well, I retired from my sixth form college tennis career when the year that the other Heather Watson was born. So that's quite a while ago. And I wanted to start my physiotherapy degree. And so I qualified in 1995 and I've worked in various physio roles since. I've worked in industry, I've worked in the NHS in a spinal clinical specialist role, and I've worked in private practice as well. Currently, I'm fully self-employed and what can broadly be described as a portfolio career, so that I allow myself to get involved in projects that interest me. And my main work at the moment is clinical consultancy with complex cases, people who need to return to work, and also working with other healthcare professionals and providers to make sure that we can supply effective health and work services. I also do a little bit of just normal outpatient MSK physio. And I teach Nordic walking.
Fantastic. Very varied. Now, today we're going to talk about work-related issues, broadly known to many as occupational health physiotherapy. I know from our chats prior to this recording that it's an area of particular expertise and interest for you. So what is it that's led to that over the years?
Okay, well, I will try and keep my story reasonably short. But it always seems to interest people. So I wanted to be a physio from a very, very young age. And really, I was probably, like many physios, planning on that being a sports orientated career. But I actually ended up doing economics A-level at sixth form, which meant that I had to go on a field trip to the northeast. And during that time, we went on a visit to Nissan, the car factory, and to the Swan Hunter shipyard. And at Nissan, we were shown their medical department. And it was amazing. It was a fully equipped gym, fully equipped medical department, physios. And I just thought, wow, I didn't know that existed. So I came back from that trip, not much more interested in economics, although you might now say that I've got an interest in economics with work. But actually wanting to investigate that even further. And so when I did start my physio training, when it came to our elective placements, I actually got myself a placement at the Rover car plant in Birmingham, as was then, doesn't exist now. And so I did that. When other people were going off to Africa or India and exciting places, I was in Birmingham at the Rover factory. And but that was really good. I carried on doing that after I qualified. I did it for free, as for fun. And but that then enabled me to get my first job in occupational health a couple of years later, which was actually at a shipyard in the northwest in Cumbria, where they build submarines. And the rest, they say, is a little bit of history. But since then, I've worked with a lot of engineering companies, manufacturing, healthcare, retail, quarries, and all sorts of different working environments. And I think I'm just really nosy about what people want to do at work or do actually do for work.
Okay, the very interesting things that people put their bodies through, particularly in manual labour, of course. So, no, brilliant. So forgive me for starting with a typically provocative question, but am I right in assuming that your passion for improving therapists' attitude and approaches to work-related issues is fueled by a degree of frustration with common practice?
Yeah, that's true, but there's a variety of reasons. I've been fortunate in a way to work at both ends of the system. So when I worked at the shipyard and in the car plant, we were able to see people within hours of injury. And that meant that we could often give them advice and reassurance and adjust their work and enable them to stay in work and not need to take any time off sick. Whereas now, the majority of the people that I get involved with are people who've been off work a long, long period of time, now got really persistent pain and very complex problems. But when you look back, their original problem was a simple MSK condition that actually could have been managed and they probably could have stayed in work with had they had the right support. So there's a couple of things. I think, you know, the NHS systems that we have at the moment, they don't really prioritise those who are off sick in any way over and above those who aren't off sick or not in work for other reasons. And despite the fact that there's a huge correlation between health and work and recovery and return to work, that's just not factored in yet to our existing healthcare systems. Then, of course, when someone does get to see the health professional, whether that's 2 weeks down the line or 3 months down the line, that first interaction with their GP or with a physiotherapist or whoever they see could be the turning point to either stay at work or come off work. And they will be wanting to hear what that person's got to say about whether they are able to return to work. So that conversation, to me, is really critical. And unfortunately, I've seen a lot of people who were either just not given any advice or were given poor advice at that outset, and that set them off down a particular route. And I think that causes a real problem. And I do think that many healthcare professionals and physios included maybe just don't think it's their remit to talk about work. And yet I think we need to start challenging people to actually talk to people about work more because it's so important.
To defend the system a little bit, in my current practice and historically, patients are prioritised in a triage system if they're off work. So is that not as widespread as I'm thinking, or is it more that that's not enough?
I think the whole triage concept is really good and that we need to be doing more and more of that. So rather than a system where people are allocated appointments, you know, when their referral came in, it came in ahead, you know, 2 days ahead of their neighbour, therefore they will be seen before their neighbour. We need to be looking at that a bit more strategically and saying, well, what is the best use of the resources? We've all got limited resources. And how do we allocate that with a bigger picture view? And if actually getting somebody back to work quicker long term is going to have a more positive impact on their health outcome and the, you know, the resource use of somewhere like the NHS and the wider economic implications, then that has to be taken into account.
Mm-hmm. No, fantastic. So with that, then we think that the triaging is what we sort of maybe do well, but then the downside is we're maybe not as conscious of, or not as aware of what we say and how that has an enduring effect on patients. Is that fair to say? Is there anything else we don't do well, or
no,
more things we do well?
No, I think it's having that greater awareness that what you say, some of what you do in that first consultation makes a real impact on that individual with regards to their confidence about returning to work. And they will, I'm sure you've had people ask you, well, you know, do you think I can go back to work with this, or do you think I should go off sick? And what you say at that moment can have a massive, massive impact and could affect that person's ability to work potentially for the rest of their lives. That sounds really dramatic, but actually the statistics are quite horrifying that if somebody's out of work or off sick, not out of work, but actually off sick from a job for more than 6 months, they've only got a 50% chance of getting back to work ever. That's any kind of job ever again. So that first consultation is a real opportunity to support that person to return to work. And saying the wrong thing or an uninformed thing that's not been thought through could be devastating.
And although this is your experience, but it is also coupled with the data, this isn't just sometimes, is it? This is, it is a majority of the time, it is super important. So it's not that we need to be careful at times with certain individuals. This is across the board. We need to be watching our language.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, you've had other people on the podcast that have talked about the importance of our language, and you know, people really listen to their healthcare professional and they really want to hear what you think, and therefore I think you have to be well informed about the realities of what you're offering. And you know, work is a a really important part of people's recovery. They may not see it that way, but actually it's, you know, an active process, gets people in a routine every day. It's fundamental to people's self-esteem every day, and, you know, paying their mortgage and keeping their family. So it's a really important factor that we tend, you know, some physios tend to gloss over because they think, well, they've just come to talk to me about their back pain. They haven't come to talk to me about work.
It's integral to our identities. One of the first questions we'll ask someone when we're meeting or getting to know them is, what do you get up to? What do you do? And that doesn't always mean hobbies or interests, does it? It means their work and that side of things. Really interesting. Because it's a topic that you and I could talk about for days, we'd better try and cover some important ground fairly quickly. Now, some clinicians that I've spoken to about this seem to feel that work issues will, say, sort themselves out if the pain is relieved, or that delving into the details of work leeches time from a consultation. So how would you answer this scepticism and sell the fact that work matters, as I'm sure you're about to tell us?
Well, I think, as we've already alluded to, that relationship between pain and work is complex, but it's really critically important. And, you know, it is important to say that of all the patients people see in clinics, there will be a large chunk of people for whom work and going to work is not going to be a problem. There's also a massive group of people who go to work every day who are in pain, and they cope with their pain and they manage it very well. You know, we have loads of people in the population who are at work every day with chronic musculoskeletal conditions, with disabilities that cause pain, and it's not a big deal to them. So what we've got, though, is a group somewhere in the middle who are at risk of becoming more disabled by their pain if they're not given the right support. And I think what's critical is trying to find out who those people are and make sure that the intervention is the correct intervention early on. So this doesn't mean that everybody, you're going to have to spend ages talking about work, but you've got to ask enough questions to work out whether this person's going to be at risk of taking more time off than perhaps they need, and more time off than might be helpful to their recovery.
Does that process sometimes lead to pigeonholing or categorical thinking? Can we be guilty sometimes of thinking, okay, you've answered X amount of questions to the affirmative, therefore I'm going to go down this work-related route with you? Does that sometimes occur? I'm sure you're not like that, yeah. Don't get me wrong. But
and I think that's a valid way to start integrating this, I think, into your practice if you haven't done it before. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it helps, doesn't it, to have a kind of decision-making framework. And we've certainly seen that recently with something like the Kiel Start Back tool. It's brilliant for starting to identify, well, what kind of intervention people need. And it's similar in a way to that, because actually what we're looking for is work-related psychosocial factors here that would suggest that this person's going to struggle, and that standard care, for want of a better term, may not be as effective as it might be for someone else. So I think there's perfectly reasonable to say, well, let's use some kind of screening questions to get to that information, and do we need to do this, and do we need to spend time talking to this person and or monitoring it. I've had a person recently who came with quite an acute injury, and everything was absolutely fine for a couple of weeks. And then she came back to me, and suddenly she'd had a crisis of confidence about work, about her condition. She'd got very worried and very panicked about it. And what we were able to do was identify that switch and start just tailoring our intervention in a slightly different way to support her, and prevented her from going down a more catastrophic route than she was already headed on. Okay. So it can change in front of your eyes, and it's being sensitive to that and being able to pick it up and act on it when you need to. But there'll be a whole load of people that you don't have to make a big change for, but you can be sure that you've thought about it.
Covered that base, yeah. But it's not always as overt as that, is it? It's a real classic case, and you'd be almost screaming out at you. Mm. When it's a bit more subtle than that, what are the top tips in terms of identifying those things? Anything spectacular, or is it just simple conversation?
No, I think it is simple conversation to start with. It's showing that interest, isn't it? It's doing more than just asking what they do for a living to fill in the box on your form. It's about going beyond that, showing an interest in what they do. And I think being nosy is really important. So, okay, mm-hmm. You know, you walk in, you say, what do you do for a living? Well, I'm a sewage worker. And, oh, wow, that's great. I've never met a sewage worker before. Tell me about what you do. And the more that you're a little bit nosy about what that involves, you know, how many hours they work, well, you know, does that involve driving a lorry, or does it involve shoveling, or, you know, what might it actually incorporate? Then you're starting to build a little bit of rapport with that individual. And they're probably then going to be more open to saying, well, actually, I'm having a real problem with this. I'm really worried about this injury that I've got affecting my work. And I'm at work, but I don't know whether I'm coping very well. So it's about opening those opportunities to talk about it.
Absolutely, making the person aware that that is something that matters to us, because they might shelve it, might think it's not for us to talk about. So, yeah, understandable. So that group of therapists or individuals that might feel that they can, if they can relieve the pain and engage this person in even exercise-based strategies, that work will sort itself out. That's too much of a hassle for them. What would you say to that then? Is that a fair point?
I think it obviously depends on the patient, but what we do know about return to work is that return to work itself is very is not frequently related directly to pain. So although a person might say, well, actually my pain is preventing me from working, as we mentioned before, a lot of people go to work every day with some degree of pain. So it's actually about getting to the root of why they're saying they can't work because of their pain. And that's often tied up in their beliefs about their pain. So actually what they believe is that their pain will get worse if they go to work, and that pain equals damage. So that's a fundamental clinical issue that I think as physios we're best placed to address anyway.
Absolutely.
And it might be work, it might be playing with their grandkids, it might be playing football at the weekend that they're actually worried about the pain meaning damage. So I think that should be addressed no matter what. And the other side of that is that pain and work and what's classed as common health condition, which includes the musculoskeletal disorders, don't have to be incompatible. You know, they are compatible, but sometimes you have to work to find the solution and provide reassurance to that person.
And those that are of the nature of saying that it's not worth their time and it leeches time from a consultation, I think you've sort of answered that question in saying, no, it matters enough. It's valuable in enough people that we need to be picking those things up.
Yeah, I think what's important is that it's not just a little bit important, it's really important, because if that person ends up going off sick and then stays off sick, what we know is that the negative effects of being out of work have a much, much greater impact on our health, on our social circumstances than being in work. The positive effects of being in work far, far outweigh the negative effects of being out of work. So it needs to be seen as a critical part. You know, it's a part of loads of people's lives and it needs to be important. And I think one of the things that can really help us think about how relevant this is to question ourselves about how we would feel if we were off work. So yeah, throwing the question back at you, Jack, how would you feel if you found yourself having had a month off sick with an injury, but actually having no support, no advice, nobody reassuring you about actually when you might be able to get back to work or what you might be able to do to help yourself?
Wow, me being asked questions, I don't know about that. I'd be scared. I'd be worried. It'd go beyond my health. It'd go to the health of my family or those around me, my colleagues. But I think fear is one of the words that would crop up, but economically as well. Fairly early, you would be immediately thinking about the consequences of that. I'm part-time self-employed, for example. That's going to have knock-on effects. My accountant knocking on my door, for example. So, yeah. Is that an okay answer?
Yeah, and I think it's just sometimes when we think, well, maybe work's not that important in our day-to-day lives, if we just take a moment to think about how we would feel if we were in that person's shoes and worrying about that future. And for some people, you know, they get very caught up in that sense of panic and see no way out. And actually, what we can do is some very simple things to help support them and encourage them and keep them working.
Okay. And so alleviating that, although this is all work related and work specific in a lot of ways, the intervention of trying to reassure those individuals certainly goes beyond just the realms of what people think as being occupational health physiotherapy, shall we say. It's tied intimately into the language we use and the pain education that you mentioned before. Yeah. How do we best integrate that in a work-specific environment? What are the key things, common grumbles that patients throw at you in terms of that hurt and harm disparity?
Yeah, so people are often worried that if they go back to work and they experience an increase in their symptoms, that means they're causing more damage to their bodies. And many people perceive that taking time off work allows them to recover, and that therefore by going back, they're going to set themselves back in their recovery and undo the good work. And I think it's important that we talk about work in the same way we might talk about exercise, you know, increasing movement again, starting to load our bodies a little bit more and increasing our tolerance and capacity for activity, and framing that very positively. And of course, reassuring that, you know, it's very, very unlikely that we're causing damage here, but it is normal to get an increase in symptoms from doing more.
Absolutely.
Another one that's really common is people wanting to, they say, I want to be 100% pain free before I go back to work. And of course, we know as physiotherapists that
that'd be nice, wouldn't it?
That might be nice. It may not be realistic.
Yeah.
And we do know quite a lot about the, you know, prognosis of certain types of conditions. And it may be that that is likely to take, you know, several weeks, if not months, until that person feels pain free, if at all, in some cases. And I think it's really important that we then educate that person about what might be realistic to expect, and the fact that they may have to return to work with some degree of symptoms, but that's okay. And again, reassurance comes through again. So those are two of the real common ones I hear.
Okay. And so in those cases in which patients are sometimes resistant to that, or they've been told something to the contrary, does that often come from within the workplace? Is that something that is outside of the medical scope, or is it both?
I think it's both. A lot of it is people's personal experiences of symptoms or pain and those types of conditions. So, you know, there's a lot to be said for the fact that someone says, well, my neighbour had back pain and he ended up in a wheelchair. Therefore, I have back pain. He ended up in a wheelchair. I'm going to end up in a wheelchair. I'm not going to be able to walk or work. So there's the layperson's view of a health condition. If it's the first time they've experienced pain like this and an injury like this, and they don't know anything about it, we've got a role to educate them about that and provide appropriate advice. There's also, of course, the same problem with employers, in that a lot of employers have the same misunderstandings about health and health conditions, and they want reassurance before they allow someone back to the workplace, because they don't want to be responsible for somebody getting worse.
Right, of course.
So they may, the employee, the patient in front of you, may have been told by their workplace, well, make sure you get yourself right, get yourself better, and when you're 100% right, come back. Now, the problem with that is it's well-meaning, mm-hmm. and it's supportive. They also think they're taking a responsible view, but, you know, how many days do you feel 100% at work? 100%
oh God,
fit.
Good question,
so I think, you know, there's a lot of miscommunication, a lot of misunderstandings. And when it comes to work and health and return to work, actually, it's those beliefs, the patient or employee's beliefs and the employer's beliefs, that are often unrealistic, and therefore create the obstacle. It's rarely the condition itself. It's usually these perceptions. And it may be that they've not actually spoken to each other. So the employee may be saying, well, I don't think I can go back to work because I think they'll be expecting this.
They said it to one of their other colleagues 5 years ago. Absolutely.
But that may not be the case. Yeah. The employer may be able to facilitate some alternative duties and return them to work. But if they've not had that conversation, then they won't know. And actually, often one of the things that I do with my sort of standard patients who haven't specifically come to me for a work-related problem is I will encourage them to go and talk to their employer and say, well, actually, find out what the options are. There may be some options that will help us.
Especially if they bring it forward ahead of time as well, and taking that on themselves. There is a flip side to that as well, as we've got, of course, the risk aversion, and which can lead to or be part of fear avoidance. But there is also, especially in you've mentioned working in the shipyards, I'm sure you met plenty of people that go the other way. They think it's a bravery contest. No pain, no gain. They're going to plough on. They will work regardless. And then they will never be struggling at work. They will be coping, and then suddenly not.
Yes.
How are we dealing with them differently? Because they don't need encouraging.
they need
a different tactic. Yeah.
Well, I think they are much fewer than the other category.
Okay.
So there's many more people who are pretty early on developing a fear avoidance type problems that we need to be hot on addressing and catching early. And the others, I think it's seeing that pattern, isn't it, in what they're telling you, that they've got a bit of a boom bust behaviours type going on, and they're stoically continuing in work, or they're spending hours there. And actually, how I get to it with them usually is saying, well, I very, very, very rarely tell people to stop doing something. So if I'm telling you that you need to do less or stop what you're doing, if I actually tell somebody to go off work, it's really rare. Because if I'm telling them to do it, it's because I think it's really important at this stage. But not to worry, because as soon as they are ready, they will be going back into work again.
And you're telling them that as well. So it's a withdrawal. It's for now, not forever, is a statement.
For now, not forever. Yeah. And it's a means to an end. And it's a short-term thing that we need to do. Because, you know, maybe there is a physiological reason that we do need to take them out of that environment. The ideal case is to try and actually reduce somebody's duties, put them onto something different, but keep them in the workplace.
Yeah.
That's not always possible, especially if you can't get to communicate with the employer. And in those cases, you have to, I have to make a call and say, is it easier to take them out and then reintroduce them back when everything's in place.
But at worst case scenario, in a lot of ways, you keep them in at wherever possible.
Wherever possible,
makes sense. So I can't have you on talking in and around work-related issues without mentioning what I would think would be the two most common, I'd say, misconceptions is regarding ergonomics of the workplace and also manual handling and the fact that there is some sort of right way to sit, right thing to sit on, and also the right way to lift and the right way to move. And so I've mentioned it already. I do think it's a misconception. Would you agree? And if so, how do we coax out of that?
Yeah, I think there are lots and lots of misconceptions around both of those topics. And if we take posture for starters, it's been talked about before, that actually what really matters is that we move regularly. And I don't believe there's a right posture or a wrong posture. There's purely staying in one place for too long is not good for any of us. So what we want in a workplace is to make somebody feel comfortable while they need to sit. But within that, they might be regularly changing the position of their chair. There is no set right position for a chair. There's good chairs and bad chairs. There's supportive chairs. Some chairs are better than other chairs. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how good the equipment is, it's how you behave with it. And you need to be getting, you know, people need to be moving regularly, getting out of their chair. The best chair in the world will not take away the problems of sitting for long periods. So, I love that phrase about the next posture. The best posture is always the next posture.
Yeah.
Because actually that's what really matters. So posture, you know, is dynamic, really.
Of course.
Manual handling, again, you know, it's got a long history in health and safety. And the thing about health and safety is that it is very much still based in a very mechanical model which looks at cause and effect. And the reality is that we now know these days that there's a lot more surrounding people's pain, their ability to move, their beliefs about work, as we've talked about already, that influence how well they can perform at work. And I think the limitations of some of the existing manual handling approaches are becoming more and more apparent. And again, I think what's important in handling, lifting, carrying, pushing, pulling is that people have a variety of strategies to achieve that functional task. And it might be different for every person that you look at. And what's important is the way they're doing it relevant to their current health condition? And does it need to be changed? And could it be that you offer them alternative ways to do it as well? So it's not that they may only do something in one way, and it's the fact that they only do it in one way that's the problem, rather than having a multitude of ways to do it.
Introducing variety.
Yeah.
Is there a place, if we think about an obvious one, which is a lifting strategy, which has been, we're seeing the consequence of people being told not to lift with their backs, and they're just using their knees and doing this really awkward, weird squat. But essentially, is there an argument to try and distribute the forces evenly across certain joints?
I think there probably is. You know, it's about sensible, effective use, isn't it, of your body to move the forces that you need to move. So being able to use all of your body, you know, we are designed to keep all of these different joints moving, and that creates our overall capacity. So I think the diplomatic answer, but also the pragmatic answer is you need to do it in the most effective way possible. If someone's got a permanent health condition, which means they can't bend one of their knees as well as they can the other one, they're going to have to do it differently. But there might be several ways they could do it differently, several different, you know, approaches to the handling technique. So they're not doing it the same way every single time.
Mm-hmm. And they can train their tolerance to each of those different
Absolutely.
Ways.
Absolutely. And a lot of it is, isn't it, about actually training our tolerance for the load. And it may be that there is a need for some kind of conditioning program to actually enable them to return to that. So if someone has been off sick for several weeks and not been doing that kind of physical activity, there's definitely a role for, you know, progressively increasing their conditioning for that task.
So training
for any other physical activity.
Absolutely. Training movements instead of changing movements all the time. Yeah. It's almost quite knee-jerk to change a movement, but sometimes it might just need...
And also, I think, I mean, I have done a lot of work with people where what we do is purposely try and find a variety of different ways to achieve that. So it may be that someone habitually uses the same position to do something. I did quite a bit of work with some community nurses last year who do a lot of kneeling to do leg ulcer dressings. They're kneeling on both knees, so two-point kneeling, and then leaning forwards and complaining of back and neck pain. Well, if you do that for 10 minutes, stuff starts to ache. But actually then when we talked about, well, you know, you could maybe do this in half kneeling. And if you did it in half kneeling, you do it that way. And then after 5 minutes, you swap and you do it the other way. And then you might want to do a bit of two-point kneeling. And, you know, people have got three or four different ways to do things. And that gives them a choice, which gives them an opportunity to change something. And that might be all that's needed.
Fantastic. Good examples, and certainly a very contentious issue. So thank you for skating around it so delicately. You quite rightly mentioned that consideration of work-related issues is supported by evidence. But what are the most important revelations in the recent literature?
Okay, well, there's been a lot of studies of work and health in the UK in the last few years for governmental and economic reasons. But just to give you a few of the kind of headlines, first of all, the HSC, who are the Health and Safety Executive, they say that we've got 11.6 million working days lost per year in the UK to what we talk about as MSDs, so musculoskeletal disorders, as they're known in our world.
Well,
isn't it? So, you know, that's just a massive, massive number. And the wider context of that is that musculoskeletal disorders is the leading cause of sickness absence in the EU. So it's not just that musculoskeletal disorders are important, they are the leading cause of sickness absence. And that might be, you know, for a week, it might be for 3 weeks, it might be for 4 weeks, 4 months, what have you. It often vies for top spot with common mental health conditions like anxiety and depression, but it's right up there. It's the biggest problem we've got.
Wow. And we know that it's intimately linked, of course, with mental health problems as well.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I think definitely, you know, what comes first, the pain and then the mental health worries, or the mental health worries and the inactivity and then pain. So
we're potentially dealing with sometimes the top two in that list.
Yeah. And I think you're often dealing with the top two. And actually a lot of the principles that we're talking about today, the research has been based on what's classed as common health conditions.
Okay.
So this applies to musculoskeletal, to mild mental health conditions, and also to a lot of cardiorespiratory type problems, such as asthma and heart disease and things like that. So... yeah, really relevant. And I think the other thing that's quite interesting, this a couple of years old, this information, but actually the flow of people onto our benefits system is still higher than the number of people coming off it. And the majority of the reasons that people go off sick, go on to long-term sick and end up on benefits started with a simple musculoskeletal condition that, if they'd been given the right support earlier, may not have resulted in their absence. And then the really horrifying statistics that we touched on earlier is, once you're in that cycle of not being in work and once you've lost your job, that's actually a very, very difficult place to come back from. So, yeah, 6 months off sick, 50% chance of getting back to work. 12 months off sick, less than 5% chance of getting back to work. Once you've been on benefits 2 to 5 years, actually the chances of you going back to work are practically nil. And that's not just your original job, that's ever. So think about the impact of that on a family and the wider impact on our communities. That's why it really matters nationally.
Absolutely. Yeah, and of course, I mean, it's scary statistics, but incredibly relevant. And
yeah, and I think, you know, what's also happening in that time period is those people who are off sick for a long period and go on to benefits is what is known is that those people then develop all sorts of other health and social problems, so that essentially they start to develop other comorbidity health issues. So they require greater NHS resources, greater social support. And I think that, you know, that's something that we can make a difference to. If we can change some of that and stop a few people ending up there, that's worth doing.
For sure. Nipping it in the bud as best we can. It makes sense. Mm. And starting with the consultation then, in terms of an MSK one-to-one, what could or should physios be doing to best understand and act on a patient's work-related needs?
Okay, well, if we mentioned that sort of idea of triaging or screening, I think, you know, that question that hopefully everybody's already asking, well, what do you do for a living? To go a little bit beyond that,
yeah,
make sure you write that in your box. But, you know, what does that mean?
Is it annoying that that's a box? Often a small box as well.
It's a really small box. There's not much to write in. So, you know, what I'd want to know is, okay, that's great. You may or may not have an understanding of what that is. But actually, it's quite helpful to act a bit dumb on that and ask, because you're showing then an interest in that individual. And, of course, your perception of what that job involves may not be true at all. Because if you've never worked in it, and to be fair, you know, if you've come, like a lot of us have, through sixth form, you know, school, sixth form, college, degree in physiotherapy, into the workplace, you have no idea, you know, you've gone into a medical workplace, you have no idea what other people do for a living. So to start asking that, well, what does that involve? How many hours are you contracted to versus how many hours do you actually do? And if you ask them, what does that involve? And they start reeling off things like, well, I arrange meetings and I make telephone calls and I type reports. Qualify that a little bit. So does that mean you're sitting most of the day? Yes or no? They might actually say, well, no, actually, I stand up, I walk around and I'm responsible for this, that and the other. But going down that kind of office environment, the next question is they say, yes, actually, I do sit most of the day. Do you have your own desk? At the moment, one of the big things is hot desking. So yeah, people may not have their own dedicated desk, which may or may not mean that they're able to get comfortable at their desk. Also, we've got a lot of people who work from home. So another question, you know, well, are you in the office or do you work from home or do you have to go to different places? Mm. The last employed role I was in was for our local NHS trust, and we have had a lot of mobile workers. So they were having to go on their laptops in a patient's home or then go back to their house or go back to a base, becoming a very mobile workforce. So I think being really inquisitive about their work, and that will then also give you greater credibility down the line. If you feel you do need to give them some advice about work, that they believe that you actually understand something about what they do.
Yeah, I think a point about the fact that a lot of physios will inevitably be a bit blinkered as to what goes on in the big bad world. Is that something that can, I mean, we could play it back to our listeners and say that I think how amazed people are sometimes when you tell them about the scope of a physiotherapist and what is involved, particularly in the variety of different disciplines we have. Think about, therefore, how different it might be what a builder actually puts his body through or what someone in, say, one of your shipyards does. So I think that's a really good point. So I doubt that means that we're all going to find time to go and immerse ourselves into industry and start volunteering ourselves with a clipboard. So how can we? Is it just those questions or can we do more?
I think you can. The first thing is being really nosy. So it's almost that the patient may well feel like you're just having a conversation with them, but actually you're picking up critical information. Okay. And as you're picking up that information, may well start saying to you, but actually, I really struggle with this bit. I can do that bit of my job, but this bit I'm really having issues with because of this pain. I don't think I can do it so well at the moment. So that leads you into your next stage. Well, why do you think that might be? And then allowing them to speak about that will start to highlight if they are, if they have any of these beliefs about, you know, well, actually, I think work is harming me, or actually it's an irritation, but I don't want it to get any worse. So that leads into that. And I think that leads into our objective in that you might want to say, okay, you told me that lifting that item is awkward for you. Could you show me, you know, if I find something for you to do to lift, can you show me how you might do that at work and what the problem is? So we bring it back all the time to what their injury is and what their work is and make it relevant.
Do you tend to shelve that? So if they're in conversation and they've mentioned something like that, it tends to be, I mean, I'll admit it is sort of more my style to try and seize that moment and say, do you mind showing me? Some people do prefer to get the subjective boxed off and then move on. Do you find yourself flitting between the two, or does that matter really in this circumstance?
I probably do. But if I'm seeing somebody specifically to assess their fitness for work, I probably have longer than your average outpatient physio is going to have. And I have the freedom to, you know, there's a set of things that I want to get through in my assessment. And at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter which order I necessarily do them in.
Yeah.
So I might bring it forward. But I think the other thing that's important to touch on is that we need a good objective assessment to make sure that we reassure ourselves and then the patient that there isn't anything else that does need further investigation, that needs addressing medically before we actually try and see what they can do functionally. So I think the objective assessment is still really, really valuable and has to be done quite early on. And of course, you're putting together that information. I really love this word triangulation, and that's truly what it is. You know, you're calculating all this information in your brain as they're telling you this, and you're thinking, right, I'd really like to look at them lifting. Shall I do that now? Or actually, what I might do that is stick that on the end of my objective assessment when I've checked everything else.
Okay, but don't go forgetting about it.
Don't go forgetting about it.
That's the danger, isn't it? So, no, really interesting. So when it comes to those, because we're in amongst the consultation now of someone that might or may or may not be having work-related issues, let's say they are, what are the key mistakes at that stage then? What are physios notoriously poor at doing? Because you're experienced, you're seeing a lot of our failings, shall we say, and therefore what are the real common mistakes?
I think the first one, which is the really obvious one, is not having these conversations. So asking what they do, but then never, ever revisiting it. And behaving as if the only thing that matters is the treating of the symptoms. So taking a very symptom-driven model rather than a functional-driven model.
Okay.
So actually it is a bit like just burying a head in the sand. And that just means nothing gets addressed. Then secondary to that actually then is people who then reinforce the patient's beliefs that aren't helpful. So if actually saying to people, I agree you shouldn't be going to work, I agree that work's going to be making you worse, I agree I am telling you you should go off sick. I think those kinds of statements, if you do make them, have to be very, very well reasoned through about why that's important for that person now. Because if you say those without good reason, you're fueling and increasing their fear about their pain and work, and potentially pushing them further into the worry of the situation, which later is going to become a huge obstacle to getting them back to work. So if we reinforce the belief that work is harmful and that returning to work is going to be difficult, then expectations of that patient about work become negative. And again, we know from the literature that a negative expectation of work is one of the major predictors of failing to
absolutely
return to work.
Our colleagues that are saying these things and reaffirming these negative beliefs about work and the danger it might cause their body, they would never do that on purpose, of course, caring individuals, but they clearly believe that. And now there's an education gap there beyond the sort of work-related stuff, isn't there?
Yeah, there definitely is. And I think I'm not here to bash my colleagues about it I think that's driven from a desire to protect our patients, to potentially protect them from the big wide world of work and to be the advocate, which we are still here to do that. And but that can mean that we can be overcautious. And if that's based on our own beliefs about pain and back pain and return to work, which actually maybe are not as well informed as they should be, what people need to realise is that it's much, much more harmful for somebody to end up out of work than it is for them to go back into work with some degree of pain. And as we talked about already, the consequences of that are immense. So if people feel that they lack confidence in discussing work because they don't really understand the links between work and health, then that's something that they need to, you know, put on their list for CPD. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to talk about it, you know, is actually to encourage people to, instead of thinking as work, as occupational health, which is a separate part of physio that people maybe don't look and think about going down because it's not their thing. So actually say, well, work is our thing. It's all of our thing. If we deal with people who are of working age, we need to know about it.
Okay. So work-related ags and eases we've discussed, and of course, bearing in mind exactly what they're asking of their body in a typical working week or working month. But then objectively, is there anything else more particular than that, other than you getting them to show you?
I think in the context we're talking about of outpatients, that's probably the most that people are going to have time for. And that first consultation, the importance of that really good objective assessment, which gives you the confidence to reassure them and then start increasing their activity, that's really critical. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's been a lot recently about Louis Gifford and the great work he did, but his top down, bottom up, we've got to get that bit in there first. If we can give the reassurance, set the plan out, this is where we're going to go, this is what it's going to involve, we're actually going to increase the activity that you're doing, we're going to build your body's tolerance and capacity to deal with the things you have to do at work, and we're going to do that through a graded exercise program, and those things that you're worrying about, we'll do those together so that, you know, we can talk through the things that you're worrying about as you're doing it. I think that'd be brilliant.
So we can't miss out that thorough objective assessment.
We can't miss out a thorough objective assessment. I mean, there are loads of other functional testing methods out there. Also in occupational health, there's a lot of talk about what's known as functional capacity evaluation, which is very specific processes for testing against various different standards. It's very lengthy. There's loads of debate about its value. It's pretty expensive. It takes loads of time. And I just don't think that's something that people need to be worrying about at this stage. If we can get the basics right at the beginning, that's going to be brilliant.
Okay, we can leave you to argue about that
in your
specialist circles. That's fine, not a problem. And so then, from what we've already touched on, the consideration of these things doesn't start or end in the clinic room. So what service level changes can NHS trusts, private companies, or even just individuals, regardless of where they work or who they work for, do better to serve our patients and the communities?
Yeah, it's really interesting, and of course not very easy to solve in however long we've got.
I had to throw you a hard one, didn't I?
I think, you know, from a service delivery point of view, so if you're talking about the NHS delivering MSK services, then, you know, we've already touched on the importance of early intervention, and things like direct access are going to make a big difference to that. The quicker people can get in to see someone, or even to speak to them, you know, so there's a rise in telephone triage. Actually, some people just need to have a little bit of reassurance and advice, and they'll be away, and they'll be getting going on their own. So the more people can access that information up front, that's brilliant. Mm-hmm. Of course, then what matters is that the healthcare professional that they speak to gives them the right information and the right advice, as we've talked about. But also when it does come to allocating treatment, you know, the earlier a person gets good treatment, probably the better they're going to be. And we know physiotherapy is a really valuable intervention and does make a difference to the time in which people return to work. So, you know, I know it's probably controversial, but I do think there needs to be some prioritisation of people who are off work. Because in the long run, to have them back at work is going to be better for NHS resources and the local community and all those things.
And especially considering the political standpoint and in some ways of service level agreements being specific to how many sessions someone has, etc. Yeah. That needs to be accounted for with those that are off work needing potentially more input over a longer period of time even.
They might not need more input if they're seen early.
Right.
So, you know, actually, if these people are seen in the early stages of their injury before they've had a chance to develop any of the psychosocial concerns that start to set in, you know, maybe kind of 4 to 6 weeks after injury or after absence, that's the point where you start thinking to yourself, am I actually going to get better from this? So, you know, the first couple of weeks, most people shrug it off, think it'll go away. But if you're still in pain that few weeks later, that's when all the worries start to set in. So that's the critical timing. So if somebody gets support early on, they may well just need their standard allocation of sessions. If they don't actually get seen till 6 months later down the line, we're then into a situation where the level of intervention to get them back to work and to recover from their condition we're into a much, much more intense situation.
Maybe beyond the capacity of that service.
Yeah, and to be fair, I think that's the problem. It does become beyond the capacity of the service. If you look at the British Pain Society guidelines about, you know, what kind of intervention people need at what stage, then they talk about a low intensity combined program, which is 15 to 30 hours. So somebody who's got psychosocial and pain related issues is in that category, 15 to 30 hours. Well, that's well beyond the remit of most of our outpatient physio departments.
Yeah, for sure.
So we need to try and make a difference at that very front end they need that level of resource.
So worry is that they might be sat on a waiting list, for example.
Mm.
So if they're sat on a waiting list in the public sector, then service level changes would be to at least be picking up the telephone, but also just giving the option on self-referral or GP referred services, that we can then find out who those people are to get in touch and just make sure we try and nip it in the bud.
Yeah, and it may be, you know, maybe just that person just needs a phone call and some advice, and you know, and get them thinking proactively and positively rather than being left. You know, again, if you think about that scenario earlier when you've been off sick for a month, if nobody's called you, nobody's given you any advice, you're left to your own devices in your head about what you worry about. Whereas if someone can direct you to, you know, up-to-date advice about managing back pain, that can give you something to work on in the meantime. And you may still have to wait, but at least you're getting some positive information in between times.
On the other side then, in the private sector, so it's an easier, readier access. So I could call up a local private practice now, and say, can I come in and see you? Usually within a 48-hour period, I'd be able to have an assessment. So the access isn't the problem. But then what service level changes can someone that's got more freedom to their service, what can they do better for people that are trying to get back into work or stay in work?
Again, that's about making sure that first consultation really includes some time to talk about work. Yeah. And especially if someone's rung up, the chances are if you're ringing up and getting private physio, there's a particular reason that you want that. And you may well turn up and say, my problem is I need to be back at work.
There is that urgency immediately.
Yeah, so that's that person's priority. That opens the door straight away to that discussion. So, then on in, it's an open door. It's just about making sure that you provide the right information.
We understand that time-wise, the public sector, and this is not going to be I'm not going to fend the sectors off against each other, but we understand that time-wise and the waiting list we've just discussed, maybe a failure in a certain catchment of work-related problems. Is the private sector doing enough to account for that, or is the private sector sometimes taking advantage, not cynically, but sometimes taking advantage of the fact that that's quite a lot of business for them that they miss whilst people are sat on waiting lists off work?
I mean, I think lots of private practitioners are aware that actually this market, you know, they've probably got a lot of people on their books who are self-employed who can't afford to wait for an NHS appointment because they're not getting paid if they're not at work. And of course, the other market out there is employers that are willing to pay for their employees to be seen quickly because they know that they're waiting for an NHS appointment. We touched briefly on obstacles to getting someone back to work. Actually, from an employer's perspective, there's a survey being done on that. And their top reasons include the health condition itself, the GP, and waiting for NHS services. So an employer might say, well, actually, we're just waiting here for this person who sat on a, you know, 8-month waiting list to be seen. Hopefully it won't be 8 months. It used to be anymore. And we can't wait that long. We're willing to fund it or support it, you know, and of course some employers have private physios coming into them, providing services. So there's opportunities there. And at the moment it's an opportunity that it potentially exists because the National Health Service isn't set up to prioritise.
But seeing someone in situ is an important part of what you just described then. So sometimes, either private or public service needn't be stifled by that. There's no reason, although red tape might limit it somewhat, there's no reason why they can't get in amongst it and go and see these people functioning in their workplace. What's stopping people then? Because it's not happening a lot, is it? That sounds a nice idea, but what is it that stops people?
It's difficult, isn't it? If you're either if you're in public sector clinic and you're rammed back to back with appointments, or if you're running a private clinic that's rammed back to back with appointments, there's not much opportunity to get out there and have a look. And somewhere there's a cost attached to it. So if you wander off out of the clinic to visit somebody at their workplace, that's a substantial time out of your diary. So I think, you know, that is an issue. To be honest, one of the best ways to get around that is to maybe get people to, and this day and age with smartphones, you know, can you take a picture of, or get a colleague to take a picture of you when you're sat at your desk, or, you know, I don't really understand what you're telling me there. Can you take a picture of that for me?
Yeah.
Now, you may not have any idea about, you know, the ergonomics and things like that of that, and that's something that is a more of a specialist sector that requires a bit more training. But again, what you're doing is showing an interest, building some credibility and understanding that patient's needs. So that would probably be my suggestion.
Brilliant, yeah.
From a practical point of view.
Yeah, having spoken to you a number of months ago when we first chatted, and you mentioned something similar, and so I've been dabbling with that myself. Sometimes the videos that they come back with, it's YouTube worthy, because it does blow your mind as to what they're doing. So they're describing something and you get a picture and it could be so wrong from the actual reality. So really good tip that, definitely. These changes all sound great, but what barriers are commonly encountered when instigating this process in practice? And that's from anyone, from any angle. What's stopping us then?
Well, I think it's interesting, as I touched on there, this survey that's been done with employers, is that the obstacles that people perceive as the reason they're not going back to work are often a bit of a smokescreen, and not something that someone set up and trying to use. It's just something that they believe and they think, and it's a perception based on previous experience, like so many things are. And you know, to people who aren't healthcare professionals, there's still a mystery around, you know, medical conditions, and they will rely on the advice of the healthcare professional to say whether it is safe for somebody to work or not. So there's a lot of waiting going on. There's people waiting for people who are waiting for people. So the
very British, isn't it? Queuing.
Yeah, queuing.
Right, okay.
And, you know, the patient is waiting to see the physio. The employer is waiting for the patient to see the physio. The patient then sees the physio, who then might think, well, actually, I do need to get this person checked out. So then we might be waiting for a scan, or to see this specialist in the department, or to see an orthopaedic surgeon. And that everybody's waiting. And the reality is, though, that if there was a little bit more conversation about the realities of this, it may be that the employer would say, well, do you know what? Maybe you can't do your current job, but while we're waiting for all this stuff, you know, you're really good on stock keeping. Can you maybe still come into work, but we'll take you off your usual job that you can't manage at the moment, and we need this scan before we can decide what to do. Could you come and do this for us instead? And actually realizing that when somebody may not be fit for their usual work, they may be fit and well enough to do something else, and not just stopping everything. I think we're quite sequential in healthcare. You know, A has to come before B, which has to come before C. But the reality is that work can rub alongside the medical process. The two are interrelated. But the other interesting thing is that healthcare, medical interventions are not what get people back to work. You can give people the best medical care in the world, but that won't be the difference from them getting back to work or not. The provision of appropriate work, the right advice, giving them confidence, that's what will be the difference. And that can, you can start talking about that at the very beginning.
So we have a duty to supply expectation, not just to the patient, but also to the employer as well, and helping them to understand what is involved in something like this. I think that's a great point for sure. And so what about barriers from ourselves then? So we're looking to, yeah, we can do better. We get that. But what is it about trying to educate each other? What can we learn from the mistakes that have been made?
I think this thing about thinking before you speak, in terms of, you know, our reaction, again, as we mentioned before, as healthcare professionals, we're wanting to look after our patients. We want to advocate them. We want to protect them if they're put in a situation which might be detrimental to their health. And we need to question that. If our immediate reaction is to tell somebody to not go to work or to stay off work, why is that? Is that just our immediate reaction because we want to keep them safe and we don't have the confidence to say you'll be all right because we don't understand it?
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. I think it's about admitting that, though, and saying, well, I don't feel qualified to be able to advise you on that. You may be able to return to work. You know, at the end of the day, some of us, it's within our remit. Some it isn't yet. Some will want to learn, some won't want to learn. But if you are able to say, well, I don't know what the answer is. I don't know whether you should go back to work. Then you need to be able to refer that person to speak to someone who can advise them. And then also hearing what we say. You know, are we instilling confidence and reassurance in that person that enables them to get active? And it might be that initially you're not talking about work. You might just be talking about going out for a walk and doing the home exercises. Start there. Or are we accidentally fueling their, you know, potentially catastrophic thinking about harm and damage? And it, that's about those words that we use, isn't it? It can be, one word can mean something and a different, slightly different word can be something completely different.
So it does get tricky with semantics, doesn't it? For sure.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you'd also asked previously about employee resistance. People, healthcare professionals and employers often think that the employee is not keen to get back to work. But, you know, again, go back to that question about how would you feel if you were off sick? Most people want to get back to work. Most people don't like being off. They don't like daytime telly. You know, they want to be back doing what they do. They may not love their job, but they usually need their job, and it, you know, pays their mortgage, it funds their golf club membership, it keeps their kids in, you know, designer jeans or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's important to them. So in all my nearly 20 years of doing Occhi Health, I've maybe met less than five people who have truly not wanted to go back to work. And again, when we got to the bottom of why they didn't want to go back to work, it wasn't really anything to do with their health condition. It was much, much more complex than that. You know, we can't understand why people are in that scenario. They needed other kind of support. So most employees aren't resistant, but they're scared.
Wow.
They're really scared.
Yeah.
And what they need is reassurance.
Mm-hmm.
Employers, they're scared too. They're scared of putting somebody at risk.
So much fear.
There's so much fear. You know, they're really worried about making people worse. You know, and then most of them are human, remember? You know, they're individual people who don't want another individual person to be injured or in pain. But they also have to think about the company and the responsibility of the company, the legal implications. So they're often scared stiff about making the wrong decision, allowing somebody to come back to work who might get worse. And again, they need reassurance and support.
So tapping into each individual's own internal driven motivation to get back to work and why it is they need work and trying to tap into that. Yeah, a brilliant way. Not easy, but of course important. And so I hope this is my super biased loaded question. Is it fair for me to say that like many of our podcasts, it comes down to good educational skills that lead to healthy changes both in outlook and lifestyle that then instigates the positive outcome that we're looking for?
Yes.
Brilliant. Feel free to add layers to that, but I thought so.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this does actually sit within the evidence-based management of musculoskeletal disorders. It's not just about work. It's about that physical activity agenda. It's about empowering people to self-manage their health and their well-being and to create changes that put them in charge. Again, if you are, you know, in the middle of your life with another 20, 30 years of your working career, then actually you need to be finding positive management strategies, because the likelihood is, we know with musculoskeletal disorders, they come back around again. If you are in active work or, you know, leisure, you're probably going to get injured now and again. Mm. And it's putting that into the context saying, well, that's what happens. That's normal. And this is how you deal with it. And it's not going to be the end of the world. And if we can empower individuals to get to a point where they feel confident to manage those things, and or they know when to ask for help and where to ask for help, then I think that's critical.
Fantastic. And first and foremost, as this podcast hopefully will do, is we've got to believe it ourselves, haven't we, as well, instill it in people.
I've interchangeably talked about physios and healthcare professionals, but I think if we're talking about musculoskeletal disorders and if we're talking about people who are using their bodies for work, either sitting all day or moving, we are the best placed profession, in my humble opinion, being very biased, to actually deal with that. Because what we offer is that knowledge. We've got the great subjective and objective skills to say, actually, what is wrong here? You know, are we detecting a physiological, pathological disease process that needs medical intervention? Or are we dealing with something that maybe was a problem, is now resolving, and what you're feeling is, you know, pain associated with stiffness because you haven't moved for a while? And that gives us, it's really powerful to be able to reassure the patient that they're not going to need surgery, they don't need a scan, what they need to do is get moving. And you know what? When you start moving, after a while, when you haven't been moving, it might be sore. And it's perfectly all right and normal to be sore. So that's really powerful. We have that ability. And then we've also got the ability to take them through the functional, physical tasks that they need for work, and to take them through that in a graded progressive way, as we do with any other graded exercise program.
Perfect combination. Exactly. It makes total sense, of course. So finally, another awkward question, of course. Some patients are frustrated by the idea of having to keep fit for work, and some employers are frustrated by the idea of their employees injuring themselves in leisure time that affects their work. I imagine you've met plenty of each of these. So what are your thoughts on how we can change these outlooks?
I think the most I've seen of it is when I've worked with employees who do have really heavy work. And by heavy, that might mean heavy lifting. You know, actually, they're shifting a lot of stuff, pushing, pulling, carrying, lifting. And those that are on their feet all day, you know, so the nurses will tell you that they're on their feet all day and that they're doing this and they're doing that. And I think that's, we have to acknowledge that, because they are being physically active, but not in a very varied way. And so often it's about saying, well, that is good, you know, and I do often say to people, it's much better to have an active job than a sedentary job, because that's going to give you a whole heap of benefits.
Yeah.
However, if you spend all your day on your feet, but actually that means you're stood at a production line packing boxes, that's a certain type of activity. And what I would encourage people to do then is look to, in their leisure time, to be doing activities that are completely different. So something where they're constantly moving for 20 minutes, walking, cycling, swimming, running, whatever it is they love, dancing, you know, whatever it is that will inspire someone to be active. But if somebody's walking all day, you know, and actually really are walking, postman, something like that, then maybe what they need to be doing is something that's much more relaxing, some stretching type exercises or some gym based stuff where they're working on a different aspect of fitness. Obviously, I don't need to go into the whys and wherefores of all those different aspects of fitness, but it's about saying, well, you're doing loads of this type of work. How about, you know, complementing it with this other type of work? Because we need to make sure that you're looking after your body, your mind, your whole well-being as a whole. And at the moment, these parts are not being addressed.
Yeah.
Because when you get home from work, you're saying, well, to hell with it, I've done a long day. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the way I try to tackle that. I also often have to have long conversations with people about, you know, the hours that they work and why they work those hours, and the fact that those hours then mean that they don't have time for any physical activity outside of work, and they don't have time to eat properly, don't have time for a family life. And so that often comes up as well. From the employer's perspective, in terms of encouraging people to be active, I think most employers are fairly philosophical about the fact that people get hurt outside, you know, outside of work, playing sport and stuff like that. And again, the reality is that people who are physically active outside of work, who are doing those things, are going to generally be healthier, take less time off sick, probably get back to work quicker anyway, because they're already people who are, you know, looking after their health and well-being. So they're not such a big problem to the employers. They might take, you know, a few days here and a few days there because they're constantly, you know, getting themselves injured, but they're probably more productive when they are at work.
Of course. And if we can help people to recognize the overwhelming benefits of exercise and sport compared to the very minor downsides to it, then it hopefully will make society more accepting to even the dangerous sides of things. And we're sat here in the Peak District, and we've got climbers and all sorts of people that get hurt doing dangerous things. But even they, still they're right to do so, and still generally a healthy way of living.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it is about finding those things, isn't it, that inspire somebody to look after their health. And I think one thing that sometimes comes through, and I saw a patient not long ago who made me sit up and think for a while, and he just said to me, look, you may love your job. I don't. I hate my job, but it pays my bills. And I work in order that I can do what I want outside of work. So sometimes as well, you have to say, well, do you know what? Okay, you don't love your job, but you need your job. So how can we help you to enjoy your life outside of work? How do we keep you at work in order that you can enjoy your life?
You got to buy the time somewhere, haven't you?
So yeah, you've got to really find that little hook.
For sure. No, that's brilliant. So, of course, to finish, we've got a few things that we want to try and direct people to, as well as things that you should plug personally.
Yeah, that would be great. So at the moment, I can be contacted quite easily. Some people will have come across me on Twitter. But what I'd really like to do is launch a new service from this. And that's going to have a new Twitter feed, which is HW Matters, as in health and work matters.
And plagiarism, that.
Yeah. We really loved the matters bit. So that was really important. So pinching that, and alongside that, we are developing a website which will have resources for healthcare professionals in particular to help support their patients return to work. And off the back of that, there will be some courses available and workshops coming along in the future. And then, of course, from a day-to-day point of view, I do offer, you know, consultancy for complex clients that need to return to work, and advice on service development and professional development for health professionals that want to get better at doing this sort of stuff.
Fantastic. And we're hoping to collaborate, of course, on some future projects, including things like webinars and getting your expertise in and amongst it as much as possible. So I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And there we have it. Many thanks to Heather for her time and for sharing such expertise with us all. Find her on Twitter at HW Matters, and keep an eye out for our Twitter feeds for future collaborations. The team tweet from at TPM Podcast and me from at @choose_health. We shall be sharing resources via the show notes newsletter as per usual, which you can sign up for at choosehealth.co.uk. But for a true insight into Heather's expertise, get in touch via either the Choose Health consultancy process or on Twitter to arrange professional mentoring, which would further develop your skills in dealing with work-related issues. There are many opportunities for MSK physios to work with employees and employers to better serve the public. However, many are paying lip service to the technical aspects of occupational health practice, and so under Heather's guidance, you can extend the scope of your practice without cutting the corners that compromise both the reputation of your services and the long-term outcome of your patients. So do get in touch if you're interested in developing further. As the podcast grows in its listeners and expectation, so does the team. Don't forget to check out and like our new Facebook page led by Rob Tyre. And another welcome to Jack March, who has kindly spared some time to put his own unique spin on our timelines and newsletters. And now back to Heather, who hijacked the sign out.
You've been listening to the Physio Matters podcast, discussing physio matters, because physio and health and work matter.